This week, as I was just thinking about things coming into this text, I started researching, because what you do is you go on the internet, right? And I found a show called My Crazy Obsession. I personally haven't watched the series. I just started to read some of the highlights that they have and some of the stories that they sort of do the series on. And it was intriguing, to say the least. There was a guy who loves mustard so much that he not only wears and buys everything in mustard, so his house, his clothes, everything, he uses it for shaving, he uses it in his food. There was another person who loved rats so much, they spent 8 hours a day looking after all their rats, which, to no one's surprise, put a strain on their marriage. Now we can easily put all that in the weird and wacky basket, but there's something insightful here around how we work as humans. You see, we're not robots programmed or ghosts in shells. We're more than that. But I guess what drives us to do the things that we do? Have you ever thought of that? What wakes you up in the morning? What motivates you in the evening? What are we working towards? Or what do we think we can't live without? Or what do we think we need in order to have meaning or purpose or fulfillment? The answer to those questions will reveal a lot about us. But this isn't merely a game of just self-assessment. We're not here just to go, hey, what are we like? There is that. That's an important piece to the puzzle. I am curious about discovering, I guess, the vices and the biases we have, but I'm keen also to examine them. Examine what we value, what we treasure, and hold it to the light and to see if it's worth it. Because regardless of what culture or time or age you're from, the human pattern and rhythm has always been that we will pursue what we treasure. We will follow after what we love. And God knows this. So look with me, chapter 13, verse 44. And this is where Jesus is continuing to teach people in parables. And this is what he says next. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure buried in a field that a man found and reburied. Then in his joy, he goes and sells everything he has and buys that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. When he found one priceless pearl, he went and sold everything he had and bought it. These next parables Jesus establishes, I think, a simple enough point about the kingdom of heaven, but one that is either outrageously off and wrong or compellingly true and good. But he says there was a guy who finds a treasure in a field, he reburies that treasure and in joy sells everything he has in order that he may obtain that treasure properly. And then there is a merchant who spends their life in the buying and selling of things. And this is a merchant who's trying to find pearls. And he finds a pearl of such worth that he sells everything for it. Now, if you haven't connected the dots, the treasure and the pearl in these parables is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus claims that the kingdom of heaven is greater than any treasure we or you can find or pursue. So much so is this treasure, that the kingdom of heaven is a treasure, it is worth giving up everything for. Again, that is either outrageously often wrong or compellingly good and true. But here's what you need to understand with what Jesus does. Jesus knows our hearts, knows how we work, knows us better than we realize. And Jesus has already made the statement earlier in Matthew, in his ministry, and Matthew records it this way. This is what Jesus says, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Your heart, if you like, isn't just your emotions, it's the internal center that governs who you are. And Jesus makes the claim that what you treasure is where your heart will be. It's what you will love. It's what you will pursue, what you invest in, what you will commit to. To put it another way, what you love is what you'll become. It's what you live for. It's where you dwell. So let me give you an example. In other words, if you loved surfing, treasure that more than life. You'd be here sitting here this morning daydreaming about the waves. You may be nodding at my words, but not really listening, because your heart will be where? The surf. Now you can replace that with anything, from work, family, pleasure, achievement, status, acceptance, belonging, identity, anything. But one way or another, we'll be driven by the things that we treasure. Another term that the Bible uses to describe this pattern in our hearts is worship. The Bible would claim that we are creatures of worship. And even secular and atheistic thinkers would say that we have that pattern to our humanity. What the Bible would call it worship, they call it other things. But listen to how explicitly Canadian psychologist and author Dr. Jordan Peterson puts it on Twitter, because that's, you know, where you put things, right? This is what he says on Twitter. Not a Christian, doesn't follow the faith, but this is what he says. It's always, which God do you worship? Remember, he doesn't believe in the framework of the Bible, but he at least admits that our hearts, the patterns of our hearts, are driven by what we worship, what we give worth to. In other words, what we treasure. And worship is basically giving ultimate worth and meaning to something like a treasure or a pearl. Now, whether you believe in God or not, the Bible is going to argue humans were created to have meaning and purpose. That isn't a bug, it's a feature in our humanity. We're not meaningless random accidents that have to muster up some sort of self-worth and belief in yourself in order to sustain your own worth and value. We were created, the Bible claims, with an inherent meaning and worth, value and purpose, beauty and dignity, because the assumption that the Bible has is that someone created you. That someone outside of us has the right and the status to give that to us. We think in our culture, oh yeah, we're all about human rights, but good atheistic thinkers will say there are no human rights. That is just a fable we tell ourselves. Biology cannot unwind that for us and say, yeah, humans have rights. If you're going to look at biology alone, we are just as important as the spider you squished the other night. But in the Bible, we're called creatures made in God's image. We are given inherent dignity and worth. We were made to worship. The flaw in our humanity then has been the rejection of that notion that we don't need God, that God doesn't even exist or matter, even though our whole Western society is built on that premise. And the negative term of that same pattern of worship, when it's applied brokenly, wrongly, sinfully in the Bible, is just called idolatry. This is the bug. Not that we worship, but that our hearts choose to worship something that is not worthy of our worship. Because it's never a question of whether we'll worship or not, but what we'll worship. Or as Peterson put it, it's always which God do you worship. So this morning, you can laugh and scoff at the idea of worshiping idols made of wood and stone, lifeless forms that have no meaning or worth. But we haven't changed an inch. Science and technology haven't rid us of the gods that we worship. We just hide them better. I love how Christopher Walken puts it in his book, Biblical Critical Theory. He says this: idols have not disappeared from our cultural landscape. They have migrated and camouflaged themselves in different colours. We think we're free when in actual fact we've just replaced one master for another. We blindly enslave ourselves to other dead, meaningless things. We think we've moved on from ancient cultures that would build temples and statues for their gods, giving money and resources to stupid things, All the while, we build shopping malls 10 times the size of what they built so we can buy things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't even like. We pursue standards of living for what? Standards of beauty. Like, that is killing our younger generation. We're pursuing identity in so many different things. It is so unattainable, but we sacrifice everything for it, but then claim there are no worth, there's no gods, no idols. We're free of worship. The only difference between now and then was they were at least more honest about the things that they worship than we are today. Again, I think Christopher Watkins nails the point. A disenchanted world has its idols just as much as a consciously spiritual one. The only difference is that the disenchanted world, thinking itself free of such primitive superstitions, remains unaware of the nature of its worship. This morning, whether you were dragged here or not, or whether you came willingly, you came with something functioning in your heart to say, I love, treasure, worship something. I guess what remains then is whether what we treasure is worth our hearts and lives. Now, quickly, what typically informs what we treasure, if you were to sort of dig in deeper, I'm just going to give you a few things that why we treasure things, right? It's usually because they hold out promises or answers to these areas. And I could have said so much more, but here are a few to think about. Comfort and security. We will treasure something that provides us. We will treasure something that has belonging and identity, that give us something. We will treasure something that gives us recognition and status, meaning and purpose, pleasure and satisfaction, hope and joy. We will treasure something that is true and tangible. And we will treasure something that provides us some sort of rewards and punishments for what we believe. It's like so much more can be said about that. But here's the thing. Jesus made an absurd claim in the light of that, didn't he? He said that the kingdom of heaven, the news and reality of the king inviting all people to be part of his kingdom, is worth everything. That it's the greatest treasure you'll ever find or want or need. In other words, Jesus is saying that there is something worthy of our worship, a treasure our heart should have and give up everything for. Even more so, he's claiming it's not a counterfeit product. It's not an idol. Now, either Jesus is a deluded monster who has lied to countless millions, or he has presented us with something that is life-changing here. To top it off, here at CVC, Central Valley Church, we claim Jesus is everything. Like, that's not just something we tag on because we're Christians. We claim that Jesus is life. You want to understand life in its right, beautiful context, you need Jesus. We claim that he's the best news out. But if that's the case, if Jesus is presenting us that the kingdom of heaven is like this treasure and this pearl, and that we here say he is worth giving up your life for, then we need to be able to weigh that up. We need to be able to examine it. We can't just live on a hope and prayer. If that's how you live, you need to deepen your thinking. We need something more than that. You need to deepen your love and your understanding of what you are pursuing. So is Jesus just a lifeless idol, wicked and cruel? Or is he actually worthy of our worship? A treasure and pearl of such infinite, priceless worth that he is something that you would want for the rest of your life. But before we scrutinize and examine Jesus' claim about his kingdom, I want to add one more reflection, and then I'm going to add one piece to the puzzle. First, the reflection. Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor, who was imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp in World War II. He was an Austrian psychiatrist who would eventually write about his experience in the camps. And it's really interesting that he's a psychiatrist because he observed a lot of things around that time, around one of the most bleakest moments in human history. He did what psychiatrists do. He observed the humans in that context. The book would be titled Man's Search for Meaning, and it sold millions across the world. The book is powerful, and it's fascinating. But what I found so intriguing was his just main conclusion and thesis, right? That humans who found meaning and purpose, especially when centered around those they love, in a context as bleak as the Holocaust, would live longer and with more joy compared to those who had lost all meaning, hope, and purpose. So regardless of what you think of Jesus at this point, you need to wrestle with the reality that we are creatures that thrive, grow, and last when we have meaning and purpose. I don't think that's a flaw in our humanity, but a feature. But again, what is giving you that meaning and purpose? What is your treasure? What is your love? Where is your heart? And does it hold up? That's the reflection. Now let me add the next piece of the puzzle. Read with me verse 47 if you have your Bibles there. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a large net thrown into the sea. They collected every kind of fish, and when it was full, they dragged it ashore, sat down, and gathered the good fish into containers, but threw out the worthless ones. So it will be at the end of the age, the angels will go out, separate the evil people from the righteous, and throw them into the burning, blazing furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I remember growing up, I used to hate when mum and dad would sit me down and tell me about the obvious dangers of the world, or what I thought were obvious dangers. I'm a parent now, I kind of get it. But here's the thing, they loved me enough to tell me what others wouldn't. They never did it out of spite. I know because I do the same with my children. Even when they roll their eyes and groan with the repetition and the warnings that I have about their hearts and how they need to think wisely and how they have to engage the world that it is beautiful, but it's also broken. All of it is motivated by my love for them. All of it was motivated by my parents for a love of me. You see, for a man who is claimed to be one of the most loving people in the world and existence, Jesus is famous not only for his ethics on love and life, but the way he modeled and sort of lived it out in front of everyone. It was next to none. Yet this most loving person was also the one who spoke more about hell and judgment than anyone else. Did you know that? That uncomfortable truth that Christians don't want to mention. Jesus is the one who spoke more honestly and brazenly about it than anyone else. Why? Why does the most loving person in all existence talk more about hell and judgment than any other person? What most fail to understand and what our culture fails to hear and can't know too much about judgment is that the warnings he gives us is because he loved us more than anyone else on this planet. So we may read things like, the angels will go out, separate the evil people from the righteous and throw them into the blazing furnace. Well, there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth with a sense of outrage, outrage and disgust. How dare God bring judgment? How dare God engage the evil of our world and do something about it. Even though when we're going through hard times, who is the first person we blame or hold accountable is God. But one thing we often do is we fail to capture the tone of love. Yes, friends, there is something serious here. There is a warning for us. A plea, if you like. Because life is serious. You can get a phone call early on Saturday morning and have a loved one almost die. Life is a matter of life and death. And our treasures and the things we worship aren't small things. What we sell our souls to, what we give up our hearts for, what we live for aren't small things. See, it'd be so much easier to fall into the trap of making Jesus more palatable here, more acceptable, more marketable. But Jesus, like, he doesn't need better PA or press. The temptation here can be to tweak his message, to go, oh, Jesus doesn't actually mean what he says. He does. But the key is to understand his message in full, not just in part. You can't just pick and choose. There's too much at stake here. Plus, if we do, we sell Jesus short. We make little of his life, make a mockery of his sacrifice, and cheapen the magnitude of his love if we downplay or remove the warning that this parable contains. Actually, there's a book called by a guy called C.S. Lewis. He wrote better stuff than Narnia, though I love Narnia. He wrote a book called The Screwtape Letters, which is, it's a fiction, but it's satire, centered on a senior demon writing letters to a junior demon about how best to destroy a person. And it has wondrous insights about the human heart, but it's just very clever in how he uses satire to do this. But there's this one particular line that I think is so fitting that Screwtape, the senior demon, writes to Wormwood, the junior demon. He says this in his letter. It is funny how mortals always picture us putting things into their minds, the demons. In reality, our best work is done by keeping things out. We make ourselves demons if we remove the warning. Just because our world wants a kingdom without a king, a heaven without a hell, a message without a warning. But as I said, this is only part of the story. We need to capture it all together, the full story. Jesus didn't start the parable with the warning. He starts off with what? A large net. This might be a surprise to a lot of you, but do you know why a fisherman weathers the sea and throws a net into the sea? Have you ever thought about why he would do that? She or he, whoever. Is it so that the fisherman can catch boots, garbage, and spoiled fish? Is that his end goal? You know what? I'm going to go and spend my life in the chaotic sea with smelly things and throw nets into the water so I can catch broken, spoiled things. No. He throws the net with great anticipation of capturing fish. The kingdom is like a large net that is thrown into the chaotic sea by the king who wants to capture people, to capture us. That is his intention. That Jesus says, come into my kingdom. I will throw my net. I will sow that seed. I will keep giving up my life so that the lost may be found and the sick be healed. That is Jesus' intention. If he wanted to just see the world burn, he would just throw a grenade in that sucker and walk away. But he doesn't. But neither does he shy away from what is at stake. We either allow ourselves to be captured by this kingdom or we face the consequence of wanting out. But beloved, friends, there is a seriousness to life, a brevity to it, that we can't pretend doesn't exist. Like I know Dawkins and all those other atheists would love us to believe that our universe has no meaning or purpose, that our lives are random accidents, that there is no evil or good or justice. But I'm going to argue that they do exist. God is real. There is good and evil. And that your life has meaning and purpose. And if that is the case, what is the cost of a life outside the kingdom? outside of a restored relationship with the King. Jesus says it's unmanageable. But because we will pursue a treasure in our lives, Jesus wants us to know that what you will pursue will have a consequence, whether you believe in Jesus or not. And yes, we can fool ourselves with those idols of pleasure and delight and numb ourselves to the reality that our world is in. But those idols will one day be exposed. And I'll argue they'll never provide then and now the salvation, meaning and purpose that our King and his kingdom provides for us. But I guess then that leaves us examining Jesus' claim about his kingdom. Now, I can spend an age on this alone. This is a beautiful topic. But here are my quick reflections on what Jesus brings to the table. When you think of comfort and security, Jesus, the one who died and rose again in order that he could make a profound promise to us, that he would always be with us to the end of the age, that all authority in heaven and on earth, he is King of kings and Lord of lords, that he will love us and never leave nor forsake us, makes the claim that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor power, nor height, nor depth, nor any created thing will be able to separate you from the love of God that he has for you in Jesus. If God is for you, who can be against you? How's that for comfort and security? What about belonging and identity? In Jesus, by dying upon that wooden, wicked cross, by paying the price and exchanging his life for you, he says you will belong to him, not as slaves, but as friends, as children, as sons and daughters who will shine as bright as the sun. You will be part of God's forever family. You will never lose that identity or that belonging. It's secured and bought by the precious blood of Christ. In other words, you want to ask who can take your identity from you. Our King will step in and say, no one. You are mine. What about recognition and status? Because not only are you sons and daughters, but you are heirs. Heirs to the throne, to the kingdom and to all things. That is Jesus' exchange. He will give you everything. You will be his bride, his love, his glory, and his boast. His greatest muse, his masterpiece. And who will recognize this? Who will recognize that you are this before all things? Not celebrities, not influencers, not human creatures who are here today and gone tomorrow, but you will be acknowledged and recognized by the King of all kings, the Lord of all lords, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the eternal, forever, creator, God of all existence. Meaning and purpose. He made you in his image. He wrote meaning and purpose into your DNA, wove it into your soul, and bound your heart with it. In his kingdom, then, you're never meaningless or unimportant. You're part of his body. You're his family, a community. You're then promoted to be his ambassador for his kingdom. You'll be given a role that no other creature in all creation has. You will be made ministers of reconciliation, not ministers of public transport or the ministers of economy. You'll be ministers of reconciliation, bringing people from death to life by introducing them to the King. You'll be workers of the gospel, freed slaves telling others about a rescuer and redeemer. You will be peacemakers and kingdom makers. You will be given an inherent worth and value that outdoes any philosophy or fad. And your labor will never be in vain. Not an inch, not a drop. All of it God sees and will use. What about pleasure and satisfaction? Can I just read a line? It's just a line from an ancient song called a psalm that is solidified in Jesus. The king doesn't offer us promise or temporal pleasures, but instead he gives us what Psalm 16 says, "You make known to me the path of life. In your presence, there is the fullness of joy." Not just part joy, not a little bit of joy, the fullness of it. "And at your right hand are pleasures forevermore." You have to grasp this. He came up with the idea of pleasure. He made our senses and receptors, mix the chemicals and compounds. He spoke its beauty and delight into existence. Of course, this pleasure maker and this pleasure giver has them forevermore at his right hand. It is unending, never ceasing, unfailing. He is the only one that will truly satisfy. Hope and joy. What can we say about this measure? But the closing words of his sacred book, the Bible, in Revelation, where he makes the claim that he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things have passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. We hope not in ourselves, but in the one who has conquered sin and death and has given us all eternity." That is our hope and joy. But I guess, is it true and tangible? By what claim do we make this? Is it just because I'm up here telling you? No. But by the very evidence of Jesus' existence, his death and resurrection. There is no one in all of history who has influenced, changed, and molded our world for the better than Jesus has. It is found in the pages of history, but it's also written on the pages of our lives. We are his great apologetic, his argument for his existence, beauty and worth. You, yes, you, the one who can smell if you don't have a shower, the one who eats like a slob, the one who thinks all these different things, you are his apologetic and argument that this is true and tangible. He gives us a universe and life that screams his worth, that is measurable, examinable. And he gives his one and only son in exchange for you. So what are its punishments and rewards then? To put it simply, it is life or death. It's either relationship or rejection, heaven or hell. It is to gain all things or to lose all things to fickle idols. It is either an eternity of joy, pleasure, goodness, the ceasing of evil, sin and death, the removal of tears and suffering, or its weeping and gnashing of teeth. A fiery furnace, because Jesus has no better language than describe. This is the place you do not want to be, but you choose. We're given the chance to respond. He throws out the net. He sows the seed. He seeks out the lost. But we either accept the king or we reject him. Now, I could go on and on talking about the kingdom of heaven and how it holds up to the idols of our world, how it does transform the context we live in. But I want to finish with what Jesus says next. You see, this king provides a treasure that is so priceless that it's not only worth giving everything up for, but it's a treasure that keeps on giving. Let's close with this. Look at verse 51. Jesus says to them, "Have you understood all these things?" They answered him, "Yes." Therefore, he said to them, "Every teacher of the law who has become a disciple in the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house who brings out of his storeroom treasures new and old." I recently went to a party of a friend's where they found out I was a pastor, which is interesting because I was the only Christian there. Catherine was sick. Oh no, I think Evie was sick, so I was by myself. And they found that intriguing. And one of the people who was there asked me this really fascinating question. If I ever run out of material to talk about on a Sunday, I was like, our church probably wishes I do, I'm not sure. But they weren't being cynical. They were genuinely curious because they know that, you know, pastors have to get up and give you a spiel. And I said to them, I'm with you. If all I bring on a Sunday and during this week was my opinions and my thoughts and my creativity, if that's all I have, then yeah, I would dread every Sunday. I'm just not that exciting or entertaining. I'm serious. You ask my family. But I answered him with this, right? I said, the Bible has a treasure trove of material that I'll never run out of. Which I did get a weird and confused glance from him. Because his response was, but what happens when you finish the book? Jesus makes a comment that if a teacher of the law, so someone who understood the history before Jesus arrives, becomes a disciple, believes that Jesus is the Christ, the King, that he becomes a citizen of the kingdom, he makes the comment that they would be able to go into a storeroom and bring out treasures both new and old. Because a teacher of the law understood the beginning of the story, not just the middle. And this is what we need to capture. We're currently in the middle of Jesus' life in this historical account written by a disciple called Matthew. And it's in the middle of a bigger story that God has. Because again, Jesus didn't come in a vacuum. And he reminds us that we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. What we need to understand is the full tapestry. Grasp the full picture and hear the full orchestra of that this gospel story sort of sings and writes into our lives. If you knew the story, you would understand the wondrous and beautiful threads woven right through our history of who God is, what he's done, and how he's always had the better story. He's always given us the better reality and future. His promises have always been more hopeful and lasting. In other words, his kingdom kind of reminds me, and I'll finish with this thought, of Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Bear with me. Yes, it's science fiction. If you haven't watched it, don't worry. The story revolves around Indiana Jones rescuing the Ark of the Covenant. See, if you knew your Old Testament, if you're a teacher of the law, you'd understand what that is. He saves it from the Nazis. And the US government thanks Indiana Jones for all he's done. This is kind of the story, right? But it's the closing scenes that have always captured my imagination. Because as Indiana Jones kind of walks off, it ends with someone storing the Ark of the Covenant in this storage facility. And as this person rolls this precious artifact into the storeroom, the camera pans out to reveal a massive storeroom full of treasures. The kingdom of heaven is a storeroom full of treasures that will never stop marveling. A storeroom full of treasure that we could spend the age looking through and still not finish exploring. We could plummet its depths for all eternity and still return astonished that we haven't discovered everything. It is a treasure worth giving everything up for. Now, either I am so deluded because I'm sick, or that is so true and beautiful. But I guess the question remains for us, is it what you treasure? Is it true? Let's pray.